Let me read Psalm 62. Before I do that, Benji is out today. He's sick, but he called Jeremy yesterday, and Jeremy said yes in a quick pinch here. So, Jeremy, thank you for filling in for us, man. It's awesome to have a member of our church with gifts and able to do this. And what Jeremy's doing today and what Benji normally does for us is similar to the psalm here. As a Jeduthun is a public worship leader at the time of David, who this psalm is addressed to. So they play a valuable role in what we do, Jeremy. Thank you, bud. Psalm 62, let's read this together. Or I'll read it and you listen. Here we go. For God alone, my soul waits in silence. From him comes my salvation. He alone is my rock and my salvation, my fortress. I shall not be greatly shaken. How long will all of you attack a man to batter him? Like a leaning wall, a tottering fence? They only plan to thrust him down from his high position. They take pleasure in falsehood. They bless with their mouths, but inwardly they curse. For God alone, O my soul, wait in silence. For my hope is from him. He only is my rock and my salvation, my fortress, I shall not be shaken. On God rests my salvation and my glory, my mighty rock, my refuge is God. Trust in him at all times, O people. Pour out your heart before him. God is a refuge for us. Those of low estate are but a breath. Those of high estate are a delusion. In the balances they go up. They are together lighter than a breath. Put no trust in extortion. Set no vain hopes on robbery. If riches increase, set not your heart on them. Once God has spoken, twice I've heard this, that power belongs to God, and that to you, O Lord, belongs steadfast love. For you will render to a man according to his work. This is the word of the Lord. All right, you guys can have a seat. Before we dive into this, I know Ryan had done a welcome there, and I also want to welcome you as the campus pastor here. Visitors each week, we have a lot of guests that come, and so we're thankful you're here. You can scan a QR code on the thing and all those different things. And because so this card's a great tool for those things, all right? It's also a great tool that if you want to draw pictures of Ryan on the back of it while he's up here, I don't know if y'all can see that, but it kind of looks like Ryan. But yeah, kids have a little fun with these things, but that's all right. We love you. Psalm 62, open up your Bible, or you can follow along on our screen with us today. Each week, one of my hopes and my prayers before I come here and preach to you is that God would make this passage personal to me before I ever even get to you. It's one of the, I mean, I pray it all the time. Like, God, I make this real, like not just in my head, but make it right here. Put it here so that I can go and communicate it to the people. And so thankfully, God did that for me this week. He did it again on Thursday, and he recalled a time in my life similar to David's. And so in 1993, I was a carefree college sophomore playing basketball, having a lot of fun with my friends playing ball, partying, going out and doing all of those things. I mean, I just didn't have a care in the world. You could probably say that I had Peter Pan syndrome. I did not want to grow up. And so I was just living that life. And all of a sudden, my life just took this turn. And I can't necessarily explain what was going on, but I got to a really dark place in my life. I started to come to the reality of my future, that a 6'1" white guy probably wasn't going to the NBA. That was the first thing it kind of came to. The rest of it was just like, what does my future hold? The reality of my life set in. The entire contents of what I own could fit in a trash bag. My grades were dropping significantly, and I just had this fear of future life. I'm just reflecting all, and I'm telling you what, there was a pain in, I don't just mean bad mood or unhappy. I'm talking about a pain in the pit of my belly that would not go away. It was a grief in my gut. It's called soul grief, where you're just hurting so bad. I couldn't eat. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't get out of bed. My life was just, there was a crisis that I was going to. And here's the reality, during that season, there was nothing on earth that could take it away. I mean, there was nothing. Not a six pack, not a Saturday night at a bar with my friends. I wouldn't take it away. Nothing. I'm talking about money, a vacation, time, a hug, a human cliche. Nothing helped me. Nothing took the pain away. Nothing gave me the relief that I needed in that season. Not medicine, money, not even me. I couldn't even look in the mirror and say, "You got this, man." Like, I couldn't do it. It was nothing, nothing that gave me what my soul needed at that time. But it was at this time that even though I was not a believer and a follower of Christ, I instinctively knew that the only thing left to do was to turn upward towards God. Now, I had no language. I didn't know the God of the universe. I just knew that there was nothing else that was working. So I instinctively kind of got to this place where I started to cry out to God. I didn't have great words. I was like, "Help! God, help me." That's all I could really get out. "God, help me. Take this away." And I would love to tell you this great story that I just prayed that one time and then God just took it away. No, it did not happen. I cried out for months, "God, help me. God, help me." I prayed it every day that I got up. And guess what? Eventually, God alone gave me the comfort that I needed. He alone took the pain away. He alone was the one who told me that everything was going to be okay. The crazy thing about it is that it took a crisis in my life to turn into confidence in God. Like, I would have never experienced that if I'd not gone through the crisis. So the great lesson, obviously, here today, you know, we're all going to, if not in one today, a season of chronic suffering or a crisis, a trial, a tragedy, or a trouble in your life. We're all going to go through it. It's just a matter of when. And it's in those seasons where they have a certain way of exposing the futility of earthly things to fix or help the ache in our souls. It exposes those things. They can't do it. They're impotent to help me in that moment. And this is a reality that we all know to be true. Money or medicine, a materialism, nicotine, alcohol, sex, likes or followers, YouTube influence, like none of those things can fix that kind of grief of the soul. Even the church will fall short of giving you what your soul needs. But it is also, again, in those seasons, by God's grace, in the seasons of a crisis, that then we can turn that into our confidence in God. Because sometimes it takes tragedies and trials to turn into trust in God. It just does. It doesn't have to be that way, of course, but oftentimes it is. And so there you go. That's David's testimony here in Psalm 62. That's what he's telling you, and that's what he's telling me. And so the title today is God Alone. And so as he's writing this, we don't know the exact place and time in David's life that he's writing this. But here's what we do know. We know that he is not in the palace. He is in personal turmoil. He's weak. He is fragile. His spirit is failing. Verse 3 says he is like a leaning wall and a tottering fence. He's like a rickety old fence in the backyard. It's just getting ready to topple over. Why? What's going on in David's life? What's got him to this place? Well, even though God was chasing David with goodness and mercy, his enemies were chasing him with accusations and attacks. He had had a lot of enemies over his lifetime, right? He was a great king and he conquered a lot of inferior armies, but man, he also got a lot of enemies. So he lived a lot of his adult life as a fugitive on the run from betrayals, from lies, from falsehood, from accusations. He had to flee from a paranoia of Saul and jealousy of Saul. So he's fleeing, he's a fugitive on the run, his best friends are blindsiding him, betraying him, and worst of all, David's own son Absalom wanted to kill him because he wanted his throne. Just think about the pain that must have felt like as a father. Your own kid wants to kill you. I mean, I don't want to diminish our suffering in the room, but I don't want to, I mean, just think about the comparison. Has our kid ever tried to kill you? Well, certainly that's true in some parts of the world, but by and large, we've not experienced that. Our suffering in comparison is not quite what David's was here. I mean, a few weeks ago, someone blasted me on Facebook. I mean, like as a pastor blast, whatever. Like that's nothing compared to what's happening here with David. But it was in the middle of this crisis, in the season of suffering in David's life, that he, like I did, came to the realization that everything on the earth was inadequate and incompetent to help his grief in his soul. Nothing would help him at all. Verse 9, he said, people. A lot of times we think people are going to help us. He said in verse 9 that people, either high or low, really important or not so important, he said, they're powerless. They're like a puff of air. That's how much they can actually do for you when you're hurting like this. He talks about the how money, his riches, they couldn't do anything. By in standards of today, David was basically a billionaire. But his billions couldn't help him. Not his money or not his honeys, if you know what I mean. Nothing could help David in this situation. He couldn't even do it himself. But it was in these crises, these times in his life, where he came to the realization that God alone was his confidence. He abandoned all other things. His loyalties were not divided. He wasn't like, well, I'll try some God out and I'll try a little bit of this. No, he's like, God alone. There's the repetition of the word alone throughout this psalm. He's like, hey, don't question here. I wouldn't like trying a lot of things and see what would work. He's like, God alone is who I turned to. Church, to turn to God in the middle of suffering is an act of worship. To turn to anything else is idolatry. To turn to God in the middle of a trial is fidelity. To turn to anything else is infidelity. To turn to God in a tragedy is true faith, and to turn to anything else is unbelief. Listen to what Puritan John Trapp said. He said, trust in God alone or you do not trust God at all. We have to see what David's doing here. He's like, alone, 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 alone. In God alone, his hope was found. Now, before we get into the text and really begin to work through what these things are, we have to see something David did. We have to learn a lesson here. Before he could really experience this, he had to wait on God alone. Look at verse 1 again. He says, for God alone my soul waits in silence. He had to wait. So sometimes when you're in the middle of suffering and the trial and you want a shortcut, you want it to be over really, really quick, God doesn't work on your timetable or mine either. And so sometimes we have to wait on God. Similar to my story I told you earlier. Sometimes you just gotta wait. Waiting is not, of course, about what you get at the end of the wait. Waiting is about what you become while you wait. While you wait on God, he is fashioning you and he is refining your faith and building up your trust in him. So we have to wait sometimes. David says, I have to wait, but he also says he waited in silence. So what does he mean by that? Well, he didn't mean he went up into the room and shut the door and kind of just sat there waiting. That's not what he means. When he says waiting in silence, he means he had to silence everything else in the world but God. Meaning, he had to silence the noise of the world. He had to silence the thoughts in his own head. And he had to silence the feelings in his heart. He had to tell his own heart to shut up. Because sometimes our heart lies to us. Sometimes our feelings speak a lot of bad things to us. And David said, I ain't doing that. I will silence everything in my life except for God, to be solely focused upon him. Because it was only then, when he waited and when he did it in silence, could he come to the reality that God alone was his rock, his refuge, his resource, and his reward. That's what we're going to look at today, these four things. Let's look at the first one. God alone is my rock, he says. Psalm 62:2. He alone is my rock and my salvation, my fortress. I shall not be greatly shaken. So two times in this psalm, David repeats this idea, this triple imagery of strength and protection. My rock, my fortress, and my salvation. Rock. Like, it's interesting sometimes to think, why does he choose this word? Well, if you know a little bit about David, I told you earlier, he spent much of his adult life on the run as a fugitive hiding. And often places that David would hide were in caves, in cavernous rocks. So maybe he's pinning this from a cave. I don't know. But the reality is he knew what a rock was like. And he knew as he's sitting in there, he starts to think about God. He's like, oh, God is the greater rock. God is the greater fortress. God is the greater salvation from my enemies. He's making the connection there. Yes, the physical rock as he stands there gave him protection from his enemies. It provided him shelter and all those things. But his thoughts are going higher. He's like, now God is all these things. He's way greater than all of these things in his life. And he says that in this moment, although he's shaken, he is not greatly shaken. He might be moved, but he's not removed. That's the point of the psalm here. He's being real with us. Yeah, I'm shaken up a little bit. Yeah, I kind of feel like I'm moved in my life by all of this chaos, but I am not greatly shaken, and I am not removed. Church, when this season comes upon us, crisis, no matter, I don't define what your crisis is, by the way. So don't think they have to be to that level. Your crisis might be in a different place than all these. But the point of this reality is when we have these crises come on and life just feels unstable, it's unsteady. Like everything around you in your life just feels like shaky ground. It could be because of you might have some shame and some guilt because of some of the things that you have done, some sins that you have committed. It might be coming because of people attacking you because of your relationship with Christ and your faith in Jesus, and they're calling you names, or you don't get the promotion, or whatever. They're called whatever. You might be at that place, and it is in those moments you and I have to ask ourselves, who or what is the rock that we run to? Who do we run to steady our hearts and our minds and our lives? Who do you run to? Think about it like right now. What's your go-to? If it's anything else but God alone, not only will you never, ever get the help that your soul actually needs. Not only that, you're just going to keep causing more harm to yourself and your life. Probably going to put other people in danger around you as well. It is because God alone is our rock. Proverbs 18:10, the name of the Lord is a strong tower. The righteous man runs into it and he is safe. Again, why it takes suffering and trials and tragedies in our life to push us to this place, I don't know. That's part of our nature. We need to be humble to this a little bit. But I love what Charles Spurgeon says about this idea. He says, let us learn to kiss the wave that throws us up against the rock of ages. His point, of course, was to embrace those waves in the middle of a storm in your life. Embrace those waves, because those waves are the thing that throw you up against the rock of ages. And you realize that God alone is your rock. Let's go to the second idea here. God alone is my refuge, he says. Verses 7 and 8, he says, on God rests my salvation and my glory. My mighty rock, my refuge is God. Trust in him at all times. O people, pour out your heart before him. God is a refuge for us. David uses the word refuge 46 times in the Psalms. He loves this word to describe God. Refuge, of course, is this idea, is a place that you run to in the middle of a storm to seek shelter, to seek safety from. You know, I guess the easiest explanation or illustration of this, of course, if you have any children that in your house right now, or when you did have children, you know, kind of like when it's in that middle of the night and the storm comes in, the wind's howling, the thunder's crackling, lightning's striking, all those things. And if you got small children, typically what they do, they're going to come a knocking on the door, if you know what I mean. They're coming to mom and daddy's room, and they're going to sneak in there because they're looking for refuge. They're looking for some kind of thing to make them safe in the storm. They're scared, they're shaken, and they need some relief. And so they come into mom and dad's room. And ultimately, it's not the room that gives them the refuge. It's their parents in the room that give them the comfort that they need. So David here is likening himself to a child of God. He's a little scared. It's a storm coming. And he feels like he's on shaking ground, and he's coming to God as his refuge in the middle of a storm to give him the shelter that he needs. Psalm 46:1. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Run to God alone as your refuge, church. The next idea here is, God alone is my resource. Let me show you this in the text. Psalm 62, 11 through 12, it says this. Once God has spoken, twice I've heard this. He's like, hey, listen up. God's already told me this a whole bunch. That power belongs to God, and that to you, O Lord, belongs steadfast love. For you will render to a man according to his work. So here, David's telling us why he's got such confidence in God as his rock and his refuge. Here he's like, it's because God is giving, he is the resource for my strength and my safety. So he's saying, it's not me. I'm not strong enough, and I'm not so confident in myself that I could get overcome this. He's like, no, God is the one who gives me the resource to get through this. He alone is two things. He is with his sovereign power, he says, and his steadfast love. These are the things that are settling down David's soul. The sovereign power of God calming him down. He knows that his God is sovereign over everything in the universe, every creature and all of creation. That includes your life and my life. That includes human history. There is no limitations to the sovereignty of God. And that alone is the thing that comforts David. Not his own power, but God's sovereign power to do whatever he wills. But it's not just God's power that's helping him through this. It's God's steadfast love. It's his love and his care, his tenderness, his personal loyalty to David that's helping. So it's both of them. And we need both of those things in the middle of a storm. We need to know about God's sovereign power. That's how we sleep at night. That's the pillow we rest our heads on, is that he's in ultimate control and that he has a steadfast love for his children. A God who's all sovereign power is a God to be terrified. You need to be really scared if that's only the God you have. And if you just worship a God who's just all love, what good is that if he can't do anything? He has no power. We need both the sovereign power of God and the steadfast love of God like David knew. And he knew this, that God alone supplied these things. The next here is, God alone is my reward. God alone is my reward. Now, this point here is not actually in the text per se. It's actually what's not in the text. And here's what I mean. Throughout this whole psalm, David never asked God for anything. There's not a prayer. There's not a petition here. And according to the psalm, he never gets anything from God. He doesn't kill his enemies. He didn't give him the safety he needs. And all, he goes back to the palace. We don't see any of that stuff. He doesn't get anything from God. What he's saying is that God alone is his reward. God himself is the reward, not what God can give him, but God himself. Another illustration that might help us understand this as well. My two-year-old grandson, Waylon, is staying with us, and that dude gets hurt a lot. He is like falling, crawling. He's doing so much stuff in the house, and he does a lot of crying. He's probably crying down the preschool hallway right now. But my point is when he cries, and if you have children, you understand and you know how this works. When a child cries because they get hurt, I'm talking like not just whiny, but they got hurt. Notice what a child does. A child instinctively runs to the parent like this. They just go with these open hands. They need something. They need something in that moment, and they just instinctively run to the mother or the father. And notice the parent doesn't have to get a blow pop to get the kid to run to them. You don't have to dangle them with anything. No, they just want to run to you because that is the reward. They're running to you and you only, not because of what you can give to them, but who you are to them. That is the point David is saying here. He's running to God, not because of what God can give to him, but who God is to him. God is the reward. God himself is the reward. He is our rock. He is a solid, unshakable rock in our life. He is our refuge to run to and help in time of trouble. He is the resource that provides the existence of our life. His sovereign power and his steadfast love. And he alone is the reward in the final end. Now, I've got three things that I want us to apply and learn from the text. And so here's the three things. Number one, we need to learn from David's response in the middle of suffering. Now, I say that because consider for a moment that if David had social media, this is his post. This is what he's telling everybody about his problems, about his storm of life, his suffering, whatever you want to call it. And notice, number one, he doesn't keep it to himself. You know, sometimes guys are like, I ain't telling anybody I got this. I'm strong enough. I don't need no help from nobody. David's not like that. David's like, I'll talk. I'll tell you about what I'm going through. But notice, as David shares this, he does not play his victimization as a virtue card. Now, I want to talk about this for just a moment because this is a very culturally relevant epidemic right now where victimization is a virtue. People are competing for compassion. I saw this on full display watching American Idol last season. And if you know, you watch the show, here's the way it goes down. They start to do a story on one of these contestants. And it's like, woe is me. I had such a horrible life. I couldn't even eat a piece of bread. I was hungry, homeless. Like they literally compete with one another in compassion. They're using a victimization as a virtue principle. Woe is me. I don't see David doing any of that. And you don't either. He doesn't play into those cultural things. He's not giving a 30-minute selfie testimony about how bad his life is. And at the very end, he tags on a, pray for me. That's not what he does. He's not saying, I don't know how I'm going to move forward with my life. I've got no reason to live anymore. He doesn't get to that place. Is he weak? Yes. Is he a little shaky? Yes. Has he been moved? Yes. But make no mistake, church, David declares that God alone is his rock, his refuge, his resource, and his reward. Everyone knows it. Church, this is the way that we respond to Christian suffering. I want to be really clear with you right here. If you're a Christian and you follow God and you love Jesus, we've got to learn the language of this psalm and speak like David did in the middle of it. Because here's the deal. Imagine being a Christian who posts about their suffering and it's just all bad. It's hopeless. It's despair. And it mentions nothing of a rock, a refuge, a resource. Let's show the world the hope that is inside of us in the middle of suffering. That's the point of this. These psalms give us language, which is super important in the middle of our suffering. Listen to what John Calvin said. When your soul is languishing, the psalms give you language. They show us how to talk in the middle of a trial. So this is me pleading with you now that when the suffering comes in your life, either now, currently, or later, pause before you post. Pause before you tell your story. Ponder Psalm 62, preach it to yourself, and then go share. Go share, be authentic, be real. Don't hide the fact that you're suffering, but you let people know at the end of it where your hope is found. We need to learn from this psalm. I need to learn from this psalm. The second thing is this. How do you find and feel and really experience God as rock, refuge, resource, and reward? How do you, I want to feel that. I don't want to just study it. I want to feel it. How do we experience God and encounter God like this? That's the question. Where do we run to? Well, we don't run around looking for signs and wonders. There are too many dang sign seekers out there today. And it's very heavy in the prosperity church. It doesn't talk about the Bible a lot. It just tells you to go look for signs and wonders everywhere. Oh, you can experience and encounter God in these ways. Just go look up at the clouds and look at the signs, look at the wonders, look at the healings and all. They're just searching and searching and searching for the wrong things. The primary way that the God of Psalm 62 has revealed himself to us is right here in this book. And if you want to truly experience and encounter the God of Psalm 62, you got to run to the Word. Yeah, run to church, that's good. But more than that, we got to run to the Word, because in the Word are 1,000 promises of God as these things. But we have to run, we have to search, we have to be treasure hunters. Now, I say treasure hunters, I believe it's Proverbs 10, talks about the Bible, the scriptures being like a treasure, like gold and silver. Who finds treasure? Treasure hunters find treasure, right? You don't find treasure sleeping in, hitting the snooze button. You don't find a lot of treasure staying up late at night, watching TV, playing video games, falling asleep, waking up the next day, do the same thing. You don't find a lot of treasure doing that. You don't find a lot of treasure doing two-minute devotionals or TikTok videos. You don't find treasure like that. You want to find treasure, you got to dig. You got to dig deep. And it's going to take some work, right? You got to get into the Word and do these things. You got to get up and search for the treasures yourself. When you get up in the morning, I'm looking for treasure today. Not just, oh, I got to read my Bible because RC said so. We're looking for treasure, church. I mean, come on, right? Let's look for treasure. We don't just do it individually. We look for treasure alone. We look for treasure together. We're called to look for the treasures together, to gather with one another, to do things like Bible studies, come together with groups so we can all look for the treasures together. Now, a quick thing of application I want to point out too is here at our church, we talk a lot about the importance of getting into the Word. And one of the things that we often hear at church is, y'all don't do Bible studies. Well, I come from a church, in the morning we go to worship, then we go to Bible study. We go to worship, Bible study. Maybe that was your tradition. There's nothing wrong with that, obviously. Do you know that we actually have Bible studies here? We have Bible studies every week. We do them in groups. We do them in discipleship groups, and we do those in life groups. We do Bible studies at this church. The reason we can't do it on Sunday is we don't have the room. But look at this room right here. We don't have room, so we come back Wednesday night. So Wednesday nights is a huge culture for adult Bible study treasure hunting that happens. It's not the only day, of course, but if you want to hunt treasure with other people, sign a card, go to the app, do all those things. It's a good thing, and we want you to help to put you around an environment to do that as well. All right, last thing is this, and this is probably the most important. Notice the language that David has as he describes God in all of these things. He doesn't say God is a rock. Doesn't say that he is a refuge, or he is a resource, or a strength, a hope, a glory, a salvation. He doesn't say any of those things. He says he is my rock, my refuge, my resource, my reward, my strength, my glory, my hope, my everything. Now, what gives David the right to lay a personal claim to the God of Psalm 62? Like, how does he get to say that, right? This is where it gets really good. He can only lay claim personally to this God because of his faith in the future promise that God is going to bring Jesus Christ. That's it. It's his only grounds. Not because he's a king. Not because of anything he's done or doing, it's just because of his faith that he gets to lay hold of this God and make him his personal God and rock and all those things. This is super important. Church, God is not a rock, refuge, a resource, and a reward and salvation for all people. I want you to know that. It's not this generic God who does all these things for all people. God is not these things for good people. God is not even all these things because you go to church. God is only these things for people who have trusted their lives in Jesus Christ. He is their Savior and he is their Lord. That's the only people that get to lay claim to the God of Psalm 62. You need him. We need Christ. Here's why we need Christ so much. Because we're all going to face crises in our life. We're all going to go through trials and troubles and tragedies now, someday soon. And they're hard and they're real. You might be in one today. We're talking about things like disease and death, despair, disappointment by other people. We could go on and on and on about what your suffering and your storm might look like. And those are real. And you need the God of Psalm 62 when you go through those things. Hear me, you definitely need them. But these are not the greatest crisis we'll face in our life. The greatest crises and storms we face in our life are being born in sin and separated from God. The greater crisis is having unforgiven sin, of looking for rocks and refuge and resources in fake places and not the God of the Bible. We've all done that. We've all gone to other things, so we're guilty. We've all done that. We've all guilty of trying to live our life as if we were our own boss. Don't want to listen to nobody tell you what to do. You're anti-authoritarian. These are greater crises. A greater crisis is you living your life today not knowing the God of Psalm 62. And this is where it gets really good, because God has a solution to our crisis. The God of the Psalm 62 put on flesh and blood and came in the person of Jesus Christ, Emmanuel, God with us. He becomes the personification of Psalm 62. He becomes our rock, our refuge, our resource, and our reward. He comes as the cornerstone of our faith, the rock. And I want you to know, when Jesus describes himself as the rock, he is the rock of the whole world. The entire world is built on the foundation of Jesus Christ. History of the world. Time is split by Jesus Christ. He is the rock of the church too. He's a rock of the history of everything in the world. Everything rises or falls on the rock that is Jesus Christ. And this is why you and I need to build our life on the rock and not settle for sinking sands. This is what you get when you believe in Christ. You get Jesus Christ as the rock. Let me tell you what else you do. When you trust in Christ, he takes you and your salvation and he puts you into an impenetrable, mighty fortress, and he keeps you forever. Nothing will ever take you away from God. Not even you can escape God. That is how safe and secure you are in the rock. He's also our refuge. Jesus Christ gives us refuge when we have faith in him. What does he give us refuge from ultimately? From the wrath of God. That's a storm that no one wants to face. A storm that's coming, that God is right to bring it because we've all sinned against him. And so Jesus Christ, for those who put their faith in him, he shelters us from the wrath of God. He is a safe place. He is a hiding place. And your life is hidden in Christ. He is our refuge. He is our resource because he is powerful and mighty to overcome death. He is also a God who's full of steadfast love for his elect. He is our reward. Jesus Christ, when we trust in him, he alone gives us the right relationship with God, and that is the gift of the gospel. It's not what you get later. It's not heaven. It's you get God when you believe in Jesus. And that is the good news of Christ. But it is only, again, for those who have faith in Christ. We're gonna get, Jeremy is gonna sing a song here for a moment, but I wanna set this song up. If you're someone here today and you are unsure about where you stand today in regards and relationship to this God of Psalm 62. you're unsure, maybe you're a little unsettled today, and like, I'm not really sure. Like, I hope God's working on you and stirring something up in you. And I hope what that is him wooing you to Jesus, because that's all it is. So we're going to give you an opportunity to do it as we close in just a few minutes. But right now, I want to set up a song we're going to sing, a song that's it's old but gold, and it is A Mighty Fortress Is Our God, written by a man named Martin Luther. You might know Luther from the Reformation in the 15th century, 1517. This is when Luther had nailed the 95 Theses to the church walls in Wittenberg, Germany, protesting, of course, the Catholic Church, their adultery of the gospel. And so what Luther did, he preserved the gospel of grace alone through faith alone and Christ alone. So it's a great, great pivotal point in history of the church. It's why we're a Protestant church, a lot of really good things. And so Luther's most known for those things, and that's awesome. But what most people don't realize is what happened after Luther did that. His life after that was extremely hard. He faced a ton of persecution. People wanted to kill him. Like he was the mole, he was the whatever. Like he called out the Catholic Church and they're just ticked off. We want to kill this guy. Faced a lot of accusations, a lot of falsehood. So he's running and running. And people are attacking him left and right. And often what Luther would do is Luther would go to the Psalms, 46 and 62. They're kind of twins. They mirror each other very much. And he would sing them with his family in his house. And he would just let these words just wash over him in those moments. It got worse in 1521, the Black Plague sweeping through Germany, and it's killing lots of people. Luther himself is very sick, can't get out of bed hardly. His own son is on his deathbed. This is what Luther was going through. This was the storm. And it is in that place that Luther took a pen and he wrote a song called Mighty Fortress Is Our God. In that place, and I want you to know something about this, Luther, he didn't write that church to get a lot of downloads. He wasn't trying to make money. He wasn't saying, I hope a lot of people get this and make me a lot of cash. Like a lot of Christian music that's out there today, not Luther. He wrote this for the church. He wrote this so that LifePoint Stewart's Creek in 2025, the people sitting in there in the middle of a crisis could get up and sing, to take a crisis into confidence. He wrote this for us, and I need it. You need it. We all are going to need this song. And so let's stand and let's sing this song together. And let us remember, this is not a emotive, reflective, I don't really, no, this is an anthem. A mighty fortress is our God. For those who believe that what you've heard out of the word of God today, this is the song that we sing. Let's sing it together, and I'll come back up in just a moment and we'll close.